The views and opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent the views and opinions of WEFT-FM, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. And now here is this week's edition of IMC Radio News.
Why do we produce the IMC Radio News?
Because the chasm isn't left to right. It's top to bottom.
To give voice to people who aren't heard.
To bust up the myth of objective journalism.
Bill O'Reilly does not have a monopoly on the truth.
To build our community and re-educate the public.
To revive the voice of organized labor.
To bring forth debate so as to animate democracy.
Because I want to agitate for revolution.
Listen to the voices of your community on IMC Radio News.
This week on IMC Radio News, an interview with a woman from our community who has tried unsuccessfully to be released from military service due to her moral objections to war. Stay tuned. Deidre Cobb is a member of our community who has been trying for over a year to be classified as a conscientious objector by the U.S. Army. Her efforts have been documented on the UCIMC website, and she has received support from our community here, as well as from progressive folks in Maryland where she was stationed. Despite having deep moral objections to current U.S. foreign policy and to war in general, her case has been denied. I spoke to her last week, as she is currently on leave. She begins by discussing her initial reasons for entering military service.
I was getting really frustrated with school, and I wanted something else that was still going to be productive, that I was actually going to be helping people instead of just learning about people's situations and actually learning the truth about people's situations instead of textbook about people's situations. And so I was trying to join the Peace Corps, but for most of their programs, you need a bachelor's degree. So then my dad was in the Air Force. And I had previously been to New Mexico Military Institute, which is a school in Roswell, New Mexico. And so I knew a little bit about the military, but not a whole lot. So I figured, well, okay, there's another organization that we're told helps people and, you know, will provide protection for people in this country. I thought, you know, I'm sure there's some things that I won't agree with, but it'll be a great learning experience to how the government runs, to the situation of a lot of people in this country who are forced into the military by their situations. And then also a way for me to gain confidence in being a leader and maybe helping to change some of this stuff. So,
what year was that?
I joined in 2001.
Okay.
And but I joined the delayed entry program, which is where you can join and then you go like maybe 6 months later or something. So I joined in June of 2001 and I went to training in January of 2002.
Okay. And how old were you at that time, if you don't mind?
I'm when just curious. I joined, I was 19.
When you went into the delayed entry program, when you actually went, where did you end up going? Like, where did you do? Did you do basic training?
Basic training at Fort Jackson, South Carolina, and that's like where you learn all your weapons skills and stuff.
Eventually, what led you up to have to make the decision that you wanted to file a conscientious objector? I can't pronounce that word.
Conscientious objector
case. Yes.
There were some things that made me pretty uneasy and. In basic training, a lot of the stuff that we were, you know, it was kind of drilled into our heads, like, you know, a lot of the cadences that we called and the way they handled people and a lot of the controlled information flow, just the way it didn't seem like it was really stimulating these young people's minds or even my mind, you know, it was just like, newspapers weren't really allowed except for, I think, on maybe Sundays or something we could buy. There was one newspaper that was sold or something. When we were doing bayonet training, and, you know, like, we'd have to scream out, you know, the bright red blood makes the green grass grow, and like the just things that we had to do whenever it was just everyday stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. It didn't seem that harmful when we were doing it, but then the more you do it over and over and over, mm-hmm. and then when you realize what the purpose of them drilling that into your head is for, I mean, they don't really talk about the purpose of it, mm-hmm. until it comes to something like what's happening right now.
And so when did you actually file your conscientious objector claim?
January of mm-hmm. 2003, I filed. That was an informal filing. And so I didn't know the procedure to file for conscientious objector, so I wrote it in paragraph form, mm-hmm. very informal, just explaining like why I wanted to be out of the military. And mm-hmm. some of that was I didn't agree with a lot of, you know, what our purpose was. I was learning a lot more on my own at that point. Mm-hmm. I was getting a little bit more involved with some activist groups, mm-hmm. with the School for Designing a Society, mm-hmm. A little bit more time in college. Just different things, and I was learning a bit more about what our government actually promotes, mm-hmm. and participates in, and it wasn't what I had signed up for.
And when did you get activated?
March.
Okay.
March 21st is the day that I had to be in Maryland.
I see.
So, and, okay. And so when I got the call telling me to get ready to go to, you know, go out to Maryland and everything, I was trying to tell them that I had filed for conscientious objector already, mm-hmm. and that I shouldn't be going out to deploy mm-hmm. to Iraq. Mm-hmm. And they said, no, you know, you haven't filed anything. No paperwork has been started. So then I realized they weren't going to do anything with that. So I filed another conscientious objector, a letter, mm-hmm. to that effect, and they gave me this legal number to call, and I called it, and it was all automated answering service, mm-hmm. type thing, and nobody ever called me back, and I never reached a real person through mm-hmm. this number. And then on the very last day that I was getting ready to go to out to Maryland, mm-hmm. I had checked in with my unit, mm-hmm. this in Decatur, and they promoted me, and they I also submitted another conscientious objector letter at mm-hmm. the same time they were promoting me. My dad was there.
Did you get to have any more conversations at that point, or was it all just writing, going back and forth?
I mean, it was writing. Actually, I submitted it to my unit administrator in person while he was mm-hmm. promoting me. And he said, you know, he told me that I'm out of their hands now. I was out of the 687th Quartermaster Battalion's hands now, mm-hmm. that I needed to wait till I went to Maryland mm-hmm. and file a conscientious objector claim with them. So went back home, and I'm just upset, and I go to the School for Designing a Society, and I tell them what happened, and some people from there helped me set up some meetings here in town. Mm-hmm. People here were like extremely helpful to me, mm-hmm. Cause I was thinking about like leaving the country. I was thinking mm-hmm. about, you know, injuring myself so I couldn't deploy, mm-hmm. or like maybe getting rid of my uniform so I had no uniforms to wear. But mm-hmm. you know, that would have been kind of stupid because they'd get you some more, right. You know.
Yeah, but when you're scared, like anything.
yeah, exactly. But Doug Rocky was one of the people that came, and he told me, you know, don't do any of that stuff, because like if you leave or you do something crazy like injuring yourself or anything like that, you know, they're gonna make a huge example out of you, and you'll probably get like time, mm-hmm. like some hard time, and you don't want any of that. So mm-hmm. he said, you know, go through the proper procedures to get out, you know. So that was really helpful also. And then Meg Miner is a person from the Champaign-Urbana area. she has been so helpful to me. It's like ridiculous. Like throughout this whole process, she's just, you know, written me and checked up and sent me cookies and helped me with money, you know, fundraiser and just support galore. And she's a retired military soldier.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just been wonderful, her support, you know, because it's hard to hear like the other side. A lot of times all you get are, you know, ads or recruiters coming after you.
Mm-hmm.
And stuff. The other side is like pretty silenced. Mm-hmm. You know, they've got so many regulations and, you know, the Uniform Code of Military Justice to silence soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
From talking, from saying anything that brings discredit to the military.
So there wasn't really, while you were with your unit in Decatur, there was no real like group there that you could talk to, or you couldn't really even talk to other soldiers about things you were worried about or not wanting to deploy, or your case. Did you have any sense of being supported there?
Yeah, well, not a whole lot, but there was one soldier. She was great. Like, a lot of people in the unit looked up to her, and I definitely looked up to her a lot. She spoke her mind. If she didn't understand something, she didn't care what rank you were, you know. Mm-hmm. She'd just, like, tell you straight up and stuff. She just had a lot of, like, genuine integrity to her, and she just seemed like a genuine person that cared about other people, you mm-hmm. know. And so she was the first person that I really told that I was serious about getting out of the military, you know. Mm-hmm. And I was hesitant about even bringing it to my superiors, you know. And she told me, she was the main person who pushed me into, you know, going to my superiors and stuff. She's like, you have to tell them.
Mm-hmm.
So I did it. But it didn't, you know, I still got the runaround.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and from what I found out since being out in Maryland and stuff, there was a guy who came to me in my barracks, and his unit was doing the same thing, giving him the runaround.
Mm-hmm.
So that's at that point when he came to me asking for help. He asked me, he's like, you know, I heard you were a conscientious objector. And I said, yeah, I filed. And he's like, why? You know, I thought maybe he was going to come at me from a hostile point mm-hmm. of view, but he asked me for help. And mm-hmm. I was like, oh, okay. And so I didn't know what to give him right off the bat. So I looked up a lot of the information that was extremely helpful for me, like GI Rights hotline number
mm-hmm.
and a lot of regulations from... you know, military regulations that the superiors are supposed to give you,
mm-hmm.
but that they give you the runaround about, and they don't, you know, they realize you don't know, they're not going to tell you.
Sure.
You know? So I gave him this packet of stuff so he would know how to do it.
You know? Mm-hmm. The case that you filed, then all of those things you tried at that point, were they just ignored, or did they give you a written, this is denied, and...
That was just, at my unit in Decatur, it was just ignored
mm-hmm.
until, I mean, it wasn't ignored. I was, like, we did the meetings and stuff like that, but in terms of really filing something
mm-hmm.
and starting the paperwork on my behalf, it was ignored.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I got to Maryland, from having that week of meetings in between going to Fort McCoy and deploying, you know, being promoted at my unit and...
Mm-hmm.
and going over to Maryland, I found out the proper procedure. And in that week, I was I wrote up my CO claim, the official mm-hmm. CO claim, and I got all my stuff straight. I was getting letters of support written on my behalf by mm-hmm. people who knew me. And so when I got to Maryland, like within a week, I submitted the official papers and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And after I submitted that, I told them that I wasn't going to fire my weapon.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, they moved me from my section in the unit. I was in Charlie Company, and they moved me from Charlie Company to Rear Detachment. And Rear Detachment is where, like, the people who were medically disqualified from deploying overseas, that's mm-hmm. where they were going to be.
Okay. Did that mean that you wouldn't be deployed overseas?
Right.
Or okay.
Right. So they moved me, or my, and I got lucky because as a conscientious objector, they don't have to, like, leave you behind. You mm-hmm. know? But they put me in rear detachment and said that I was going to stay there until my conscientious objector case was resolved.
Mm-hmm. And then how long did it take them to process your case?
It took from March until November 13th.
Wow.
Yeah.
And the result was that they denied it?
Right.
Okay. And can you talk about the grounds they gave? Did you get to have a meeting to discuss it?
Well, the first thing that happened in the case was I had a chaplain's interview, and then a psychiatrist interview, and then an investigating officer. Mm-hmm. The chaplain recommended an approval to my case.
Mm-hmm.
The psychiatrist, said that I was fine. And then the first investigating officer recommended an approval. Then maybe like 2 or 3 weeks out after waiting for my packet to go up the chain of command, then it came back and this assistant to the second investigating officer comes and has me sign this thing saying that I'm going to do another investigative hearing. And I sign it, and then I'm like, wait a minute, I just did one like a few weeks ago.
Right.
Like, what's this about?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I start calling around asking people, why am I doing another one? And they tell me that the first one was insufficient by JAG, the mm-hmm. people at JAG. So we do a second investigative interview. My lawyer was present at the second one. The second one recommended a disapproval. My lawyer told me that he was not surprised that the officer recommended a disapproval because the whole time we were sitting in there, he said she had a very attacking attitude towards my case. Instead of having an objective, you mm-hmm. know, approach to it, it seemed like she was hunting for things to compile a reason mm-hmm. to deny.
So where did it followed then, I guess, on the second investigative officer's recommendation that they denied your application?
Right.
Okay.
So she denied it, and then I wrote the rebuttal, and then after that, it goes to, like, several people before it reaches the conscientious objector review board.
Mm-hmm.
So I never got to see the recommendations or explanations of all those people in between.
Mm-hmm.
And even the conscientious objector review board explanation was, like, extremely vague about why they were denying me.
So is there no further avenue in terms of the dishonorable, or in terms of the CO case? Like, you're basically stuck there. You can't refile or...
Well, you can refile, and that's something that I've considered refiling. Mm-hmm. But right now, J.E. McNeil from the Center on Conscience and War, she's mm-hmm. trying to hook me up with a lawyer that's in the Chicago area.
Mm-hmm.
And, I guess actually right in the city. And that person is already working on someone else's writ of habeas corpus, which is filing a federal appeal. It seems like the more you fight against the government, the more you, like, try and expose things, especially if you're in a very small position, the more they're going to try and, like, squash you and be like, make you an example. And so I don't know if I'm going to be successful with this or not, but because I was really, really, really optimistic when I first started trying to apply for this. You know,
mm-hmm.
I was like, I know I'm sincere, you know, and that's the toughest, I had heard that's the toughest part in conscientious objector cases is proving that you're sincere.
Mm-hmm.
And then, towards the end, I'm like, oh, I get it. The reason why it's the toughest part is because it's a huge loophole.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like,
right.
they have to say is, you know, you did not sufficiently,
right.
you know, provide evidence that you were sincere, and bam, you're denied.
Because there's no scale for sincerity.
Right.
They can say you're down here.
Right.
It doesn't matter what you feel.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I'm like, oh, man. I'm probably going to be going up a system just chock full of loopholes, you know,
uh-huh.
and in their, you know, in their favor. And I don't know how successful I'm going to be. That's why I'm just trying to, like, get this as public as possible,
mm-hmm.
Not just for my sake, but for other people's sake who
mm-hmm.
really feel how I feel and are up against this system that tries to make you feel like you're all alone in this,
mm-hmm.
tries to make you feel like, you know, there's no way of succeeding. So.
When your 60 days is up, are you expected to go back to Maryland?
Yeah, I'm supposed to go back, but just for 1 week in a month, because I'm back on reserve.
Oh, so you're back in reserve. So is there a chance that they could activate you and send you back out?
Yeah, there's definitely a chance. Yeah. There's a chance that everyone who went
mm-hmm.
and has been demobilized can be called up to, you know, mobilize mm-hmm. and deploy again.
I see.
And it's highly likely that a lot of us will, okay. because, you know, rotations have already been planned out. Whether they've released them to the public or not, I'm not sure, but, you know, I've already, you know, received information that these things have been planned out for a while now, mm-hmm. actually. And there was an officer I was talking to, and he was saying, you know, he's been out there, I think, 3 times already. And, you know, he said, you know, they've already told him that basically he can expect to be going over the next 5 years.
Wow.
You know, on different rotations. And
is there like sort of a silent group of conscientious objectors, whether they filed or not, that you've met, or do people talk about it?
Oh yeah, I mean, people talk about like not agreeing with what's going on, and I don't know, it's been kind of frustrating actually, because you deal with the whole issue of, yeah, it seems really easy to say I don't agree with what's going on, you know, and I would rather not participate in this. But mm-hmm. then you look at a lot of the people who they're targeting to go into the military, and they're not there because they agree with what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? They're there because, you know, a stable job,
mm-hmm.
A place to live, some structure,
mm-hmm.
you know, police off their backs,
mm-hmm.
you know, just all kinds of other reasons besides,
mm-hmm.
you know, besides agreeing with what's going on. So a lot of people don't agree with what's going on, but a lot of people are going to stay there. A lot of people are still going to reenlist.
The front that's presented is that that you would be the only, like the idea there that we would get from the government or from the Army or just the public image is that there might be a few oddballs who object, but in general the Army's full of people who just think that it's a great idea. And so
I was talking to the same officer that I was talking to that said he was probably going to be deployed over the next 5 years, you know, on and off. He said that, you know, he's been over there. He was over there with the military police unit.
Mm-hmm.
And he said it was just a mess.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you know, they were arresting people for like little minor infractions, maybe being past curfew for a few minutes or, you know, minor things. And there's no legal system set up now. So people are sitting in jail for like months and months and months for these little minor infractions. And he just said, it's just like chaos. And of course, that's going to upset people because they don't know where their family members are,
mm-hmm.
or they know where they are, but there's no way to get them out. I can't imagine what is going on over there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what they're having to endure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and most of our soldiers are getting to come home. You know, most of them are coming home.
Mm-hmm.
But those people, they got to stay there in that.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And I just can't imagine. I can't even imagine that I'm putting on. I felt so angry that I'm still putting on this uniform.
Mm-hmm.
That, like, and I always get choked up when I start talking about this, but mm-hmm. I'm still putting on this uniform.
Mm-hmm.
And these people are dying. And, like, I was looking at pictures of these little kids when I was at my unit. I had, like, pictures of these kids that were, like, maimed by these bombs that were dropping on them.
Mm-hmm.
And, people were looking over my shoulder, you know, in my unit. And they're like, you know, what are you looking at? And I was like, you know, this is what we're doing over there. This is what we're doing to these people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some people were trying to be sarcastic and be like, you know, good. And, you know, we need to do it to 10,000 more or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then eventually, like, people got serious and they were like, turn that off, you know? Like, why are you looking at that stuff? Mm-hmm. And I was like, this is what you're being sent over there to do. This is what we're being paid to do. It's mm-hmm. like, if you can't look at it, then why are you doing it?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I was like, you know, you're supporting it. I was like, you should be able to look at it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, it's just been so overwhelming for me. I've just learned a lot since yeah, I've been you have. Out. And it just makes me all that much more angry. And all that much more angry and just sort of angry at myself a little bit. Well, a lot, that I keep putting this uniform on, you know, and
well,
and I know that if I take it off, the only reason I told people in my unit, almost, you know, if they asked me, I would tell them straight up, you know, the only reason I put this on is so I don't go to jail.
That's all the time we have in this show, but Deidre went on to describe several underhanded tactics the Army has used in order to discourage her efforts, which have damaged her record and cost her over $1,000 from her own pocket. If you'd like to learn more about her situation, visit the UCIMC.org website or email radio@UCIMC.org to be placed in contact with Deidre. That wraps up IMC Radio News. If you'd like to get involved with the production of this show, please stop by the weekly meeting at 5:30 p.m. on Tuesdays at the IMC 218 West Main Street in downtown Urbana, or call 344-8820 extension 1. Take care, and see you next week.